WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. That's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth, Charlie Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it was really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but...
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us, sir. How are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome and good evening. You are indeed tuned in to Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD. My name is Kevin Tachi, and I'm not flying solo this week. I have actually decided to share the airspace, the microphones this week. I actually have brought in a professional sidekick. Actually, no, he is going to be my co-host. He is Matt Mad Dog Nelson, and he's going to be my wingman this evening. What's up, Matt?
Going to get that on a business card. That was brilliant.
You like that?
A professional sidekick.
Yes.
Love it. That is me.
Is it? We have a great show lined up for you. I know I utter those words every week. But what's even more interesting is that two of our guests are actually on our active intro. It's kind of funny. We're going to kick things off after traffic, Matt. Who's our first guest?
We have Plymouth County District Attorney, none other than Tim Cruz, in studio.
Yeah, and he's actually warming up in the bullpen. He'll join us in a couple of moments right after traffic, unless we pull him in prior to traffic. But we also have, following Tim Cruz, is John Keenan, state senator. He'll be joining us. We'll chat with him, get caught up with the State House report. So we kind of, it's the staple early on in the show. We get all the political stuff out of the way. Hour number two, who is our guest starting at 7 o'clock, Matt?
7 o'clock, we have Mary Duggan Lee Watson, Massachusetts Hall of Fame coach. We're talking about 50 years of Title IX and how that's kind of changed the sports landscape.
It is. I'm looking forward to it. Just having conversations with her about what she had to endure, not only as a player herself, but then when she began coaching back prior to 1972, that's when that landmark decision came down. What was it like for the transition for the next couple of years to kind of get equality when it came to playing sports and women playing sports? And then we're going to wrap things up with Jerry Thornton. Jerry, of course, we heard him for a moment there on the intro as well. But knowing that he goes to the New England Patriots training camp, he can kind of give us a little bit of inside baseball, crossing sports there. But looking forward to it because we know Jerry is very passionate. I also want to see how he's doing with the new QB. We know he had a love affair with TB12. We know TB12 is shipped off to Tampa Bay. So we'll get his take on how things are going. Anybody who's paid attention to what the pundits are saying, a lot of them are questioning the three-headed monster for offensive coordinator between Bill and Joe Judge and Matt Patricia, what's going on, and who's running the defense. Jerry will give us all those details. I'm definitely looking forward to that. What are you looking forward to as part of today's show, Matt?
It's a very solid mix, as it always is, whenever you have me on, of politics and sports, two of my, not necessarily areas of expertise, but two topics that I like to stay up to date on. And
you're a sports guy, so that was the key why you were brought in, because you are one of the best local sports commentators when it comes to local sports. You name it. You're very versatile, whether it's hockey, basketball. I think I've heard you call lacrosse a few times.
The sports I never thought I'd ever hear myself calling.
That is correct. But you do a phenomenal job, and you've done it all over the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, depending on how those sports teams are doing. So thought we would bring you in, especially we're talking about some high school sports and Title IX. I thought you would be a valuable asset.
Pretty good built-in bridge here, too, is sports betting just passed in the State House. That might be on the topic of with Senator Keenan.
As I would consider, I'm wondering how they actually worked it all out. I think I've seen some reports how they're actually going to try to do this and what you need to have in order to make this. So, I mean, I think I saw something regarding random dog track could be new life and how they're going to make that all happen. The Carnies, as they had dog racing up until 2009, and then the voters spoke and dog racing was no more here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. So they're looking forward to doing, I think they were doing on... They do some kind of off-track betting. Thank you, D.A. Cruz. They were doing that for some time. They might still be doing some of it, but they're looking forward to some new life and be able to do something like that. So we will now pull over just for half a second and get a final look at the roadways being brought to you on this end by Brennan's Smoke Shop. With locations in Plymouth, Pembroke, Brockton, Wareham, Raynham, Taunton, Stoughton, New Bedford, Weymouth, and now Hudson, New Hampshire.
Listen, guys, some of us aren't even in the first quarter of our lives. Some of us, me, are just getting to halftime. These people over here are the biggest part of the team, and they're at the end of their fourth quarter. We got to get up off the bench and start playing this game hard, because if we don't, we're going to lose this game of life. Of survival. We don't sit on the bench and watch our teammates lose. We get up and we play harder and we work harder than the other team. We play every quarter like it's the fourth quarter. Home runs, knockouts, strikeouts, hat tricks, triple plays, Hail Marys, QB sack in the fourth quarter, interceptions, half court shots. Let's go, guys. Let's go. We need the whole team off the bench and in the game today. Brennan's Smoke Shop, Plymouth, Pembroke, Brockton, Wareham, Raynham, Taunton, Stoughton, New Bedford, and now in Hudson, New Hampshire. Brennan's Smoke Shop, the best smoke shop in Massachusetts and New Hampshire. Customers must be 21 years of age or older, and proper ID is required.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk. Don't just listen, say something. Call 781-837-4900. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
All right, we are back. Matt, I'm going to ask you a question. When you think of crime fighters, what comes to mind?
Well, immediately after, like, the Ghostbusters and the Avengers and all of the superheroes and things that I've seen on the big screen, I usually think local.
So do I. I think of Tim Cruz, Plymouth County District Attorney. No, you can keep that. That's yours, District Attorney.
Thanks, appreciate it.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I appreciate the opportunity to come on and talk a little bit tonight. It's nice to be here.
Let's talk about the re-election campaign.
Yeah.
How are things going? What are you hearing from the folks out on the streets?
Yeah, I think things are going great. I mean, people are very happy, I think, with the work that we've been doing over the course of the last 21 years, and they've seen our numbers have gone down significantly, crime-wise, and also the incarceration rates down significantly. And they understand that we look at it in really a really holistic approach, trying to deal with things on the front end, the back end, and hold people accountable in the middle. I think that's important. And when you do that stuff, you can watch your crime numbers go down.
How would you say this is your, third election, fourth election?
Six.
Wow, they go by so fast. How have the issues changed from election to election? Everything very much the same, or do the issues seem to grow?
Yeah, I think they're different. I mean, I think they change over time. I think the world's changed over time. So therefore, there's different issues. And of course, when I first started out as district attorney 20 years ago, there really was a low-level internet, if any at all, at that time. We were using phones, you know, that were chirping each other at that point. You know, those old phones
beepers.
And now the world is different. So as we've proceeded down that road and as we continue to do our job and make the changes that we need to make, we do that.
One of the issues that has not necessarily changed as an issue is gun violence. So tell us, how tough has your office been and how have those problems kind of changed over time, if they have?
Well, I mean, I think they've certainly changed, especially when I first came into office those many years back, when gun violence was really a very dangerous situation occurring in the city of Brockton, and also it affects not just Brockton. Remember, it affects the adjoining communities right around, and affects our whole county. So, I mean, we've been working really hard on trying to deal with federal programs. We've been doing it for 20 years. Project Safe Neighborhood, which is a federal anti-gun, anti-violence, and bringing in an engagement from the community and going into that direction. We've been doing that. We were selected as one of four spots on the national basis just 4 years back. We were in the original PSN back 2008, Weed and Seed Program, Safe Streets is another thing we've been doing. Working with the community, sharing information, making sure that we can go forward and target the small group of individuals who are committing the vast majority of crime. It's always that way. And when you work with people, and I'm talking state, local, federal, when you sit down with the FBI, DEA, ATF, parole, probation, state police, and you sit down and you communicate and have effective conversations, you can know who to remove from the street because they're dangerous individuals and they're hurting people, and we need to make sure we remove them. So therefore, we've been doing different versions of this for the last 20 years, and right now we continue to focus on priority firearm cases in our courts, and we have a special prosecutor assigned to them. We try to move them as quickly as we can because these guns need to be taken off the streets. There's unfortunate relationships between our communities and Boston and things such as that, so we're always working with our other partners in that direction, sharing information, and when some things happen, sometimes it's a very seamless transition trying to work together and knowing who we have to continue to protect the community from.
Let's talk about transparency and talk about your work. You've done many cable shows. You appear regularly here on 95.9 WATD and bring folks up to speed as to what's going on. Social media, I always see things that are going on when it comes to your office. How important is that, getting the word out about what is going on in your office and the many things that you offer to the community to keep the communities safe, the 27 communities you represent?
Right. I mean, I think it's very important, and we continue to try to do that as best as we can. Normally, when people see me out there, it's because something terrible's happened. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did. I've been on call for 20-some-odd years, and I go to homicide scenes, and I work with the state police and the local police. But many people don't know about all the preventative things that we do in our office and the many different relationships that we have with community groups all throughout, whether it be, you know, when the opioid crisis really kicked in 2013, 2014, and we developed the Plymouth County Drug Abuse Task Force and Plymouth County Outreach and Plymouth County Hope, working with all the various towns and their different FAC communities, whether it be Scituate FACs or Marshfield FACs or Plymouth Youth Development Corp, working with all these different groups, sharing information. And we put together our task force back in 2015, myself and Sheriff McDonald, because we saw all these other groups and they were meeting every day of the week. Can't we put together and become a clearinghouse of getting information, getting people who are smarter than us, who deal with these issues, education, legislators, judges, faith-based people, bring them in the same room, talk about these issues. And I think we've been able to do that, and we have watched our opiate fatal numbers go down. So a lot of the things that we're doing now with drug-endangered children and trying to make all of our schools trauma-sensitive, understanding that we need to help kids and keep them out of cycles of domestic violence or child abuse, keeping them out of the criminal justice system, that's really important. And on the back end, the reentry programs, the guys who are in doing time, because 99% of those guys are coming back out. We have to help them get education, get work opportunities, anger management skills, drug issues, getting them back in. Myself and the sheriff and Mayor Sullivan do Corey-friendly job fairs. You know, every 6 months we do them in Brockton, and getting people real jobs, because I'm not talking like you're going to be working some part-time gig at a fast food restaurant. I'm talking about working with IBEW. We're trying to get plumbers involved in that. Real trades, real money, and help these guys get on their feet. And I think as a result of doing that, we've watched the incarceration rates in Plymouth County and in Massachusetts. It's now 50 out of 50. That means we are the lowest per population individuals doing time. So in Plymouth County House of Correction right now, I continually hear about these phrases of mass incarceration, which is an absolute myth in Massachusetts. As of last week, I believe it was, the number of people that were doing time in the Plymouth County House of Correction was 83. We have 530,000 people here. When you look at DOC, which is the Walpoles, the Susan Baranowskis, the real serious murders, rapists, trafficking like that, back 10 years ago, they had almost 12,000 inmates. As we sit here right now, there's about 6,100. Working together, working smarter, making sure there's less people in jail, and making sure that the people who deserve to be there, that they are there.
Right, reduce the recidivism.
Absolutely.
Matt, you had a question.
You mentioned the opioid crisis and the various partnerships, and we saw that just within the last couple of weeks, there was another one of those massive 35, 40 people stings where you're taking out this major network that happens to be distributing drugs in cities like Brockton and its surrounding towns. How do those come together, and how has the opioid crisis kind of changed over your 21 years in office?
Well, I mean, there's always been opioid issues. I mean, I've been, although I've been a DA for 21 years, I was an assistant DA back in 1983, 84, 85. That's when I started, and then I was a criminal defense lawyer in the middle. This is all I've ever done, really, for 37, 38 years. So, you know, heroin's always been around. It was around when I was prosecuting in the 80s. And now, as it's morphed into oxycodone, oxycontin, fentanyl, carfentanil, all these really insidious, dangerous drugs that you really need a hazmat suit to get near, very dangerous stuff, as we've seen it get much more challenging in that fashion, we've continued to double down on the individuals who are selling these drugs, not the users. You need to help the users to the extent that you can, but you also have to hold them accountable, which is why we have drug courts, we have veterans court, we have mental health courts, we have things in the middle, we have things on the front end, we have things on the back end. So as you deal with these serious, significant drugs, how do you make sure you can help somebody that gets involved with them? How do you, you know, you talk to people that their kids would do anything they could, you know, parents do anything to help their children, obviously. The biggest detox that we have in Plymouth County is the Plymouth County House of Correction. And therefore, we have to make sure people can get beds and they can get help and get on their feet and make sure that they're not going to continue to go back out and steal and try to feed their habit. And I think, you know, we've watched our numbers go significantly down in Plymouth County over the course of the last 5 years. The only spike we've had was during COVID. That's because, in my opinion, the PCO, Plymouth County Outreach, which came out of our task force, PCO was unable to go to people's homes and talk to them and bring them information to overcome that stigma and making sure that we can deal with that. Since then, this year, Plymouth County is the only county in Massachusetts where the fatal opiate overdoses have gone down. Everywhere else, they're going up. One's too many, but it's good to know that the direction's going down.
Let's talk about some of the programs your office provides to not only better inform, but to protect residents. What are a few of the programs that you offer that you are the proudest of?
Well, I think right now the thing that really is cutting edge is the Drug Endangered Children Initiative that we've been dealing with. And that really emanated out of the children who witnessed violence. We did it in Brockton almost 20 years ago. And kids were traumatized in their homes. And the next day they were going to school, and the schools didn't know anything about what was going on. And these poor kids were walking in. And when you're 7, 8, 9 years old, you think the whole world is watching you. They know your whole business. And you walk in and nobody says anything. So if you're 7, 8, or 9, what are you thinking? Nobody cares. How do you get the information from the police to the school? So we ended up developing a program, which another West Virginia jumped in on with us. We worked great with them. We went down there and taught them, trained them on what we were doing, making sure that we could get this program together called Handle With Care. And now all that happens is if they're in one of our trauma-sensitive schools, if you are a Handle With Care school, if something happens, say, in the city of Brockton, the next day there's going to be a call from the police officer to that school. And all they're going to say is, Johnny Doe. Handle him with care. That means they're going to watch that child and make sure that, because we're going to train them to be trauma sensitive and help the kids who are high at-risk kids already, making sure they can get the help that they need. And if they need more than the teachers can provide, we're going to have some other mental health resources there to help those kids. If you can keep those kids out, the kids that are seeing these terrible things in their lives, kids from broken homes, people that don't have a mentor in their life, you know, we need to make sure that we help those children. We make sure that they're fed, and we need to make sure that they're going to be helped so that they're not going to be in those cycles of what's known as adverse childhood experiences. The more ACEs you have, adverse childhood experiences that you have, the more likely it is you're also going to be using drugs in the next few years. How do we stop that? How do we stop cycles of child abuse? How do we stop cycles of domestic violence? Through our Children's Advocacy Center, it's been a great tool for us. You know, we have more than 1,000 complaints of child abuse every year in Plymouth County alone. Yes, we're going to prosecute the bad guys to the extent that we can, but how do you get those kids the help that they need and stop those cycles? Today's victim could very well be tomorrow's perpetrator. That's what we've been trying to do, and as a result of that, our numbers have gone down.
If you're just tuning in, you're tuned in to Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD, and our guest right now is Tim Cruz, Plymouth County District Attorney. Matt, you have the next question.
Many different divisions and units under the Plymouth County District Attorney's Office. If you would just touch on a couple of them, what do they offer, and have they always existed, or have you kind of implemented different departments and units as you've come along the last 20 plus years?
Yeah, I mean, we've certainly, you know, rolled with the punches, you know, as things change and things develop. So we've certainly done that, and we've focused, you know, we have the gun protection team, and we have the safety first team with domestic violence, and we have all these different issues that are going on, the family protection team, so that if a senior is attacked, or if somebody along those lines is a domestic violence case, we can make sure that we can provide the resources that we can to help that person either get their restraining orders, or also how can we help them and provide them with information for their cases. more recently, we just got a grant probably a year or so back, $1.5 million. We work with Health Imperatives regarding human trafficking right now. Human trafficking is something that's been out there, and many times with our trainings of police officers, we bring in people that talk about these issues and say what to look for. They show up at a scene and they make sure that they can try to help those the kids who are involved. So lots of times it's young people, and they're stuck in this world of violence, of sex and money and drugs and things such as that. And I think with that grant, we've been doing lots of trainings, and as a result of the trainings, we've been seeing these people say, oh, your numbers have gone up. I think our numbers have remained the same. I think people know, the police officers know more what to look for, and as a result of that, they're trying to make sure they can get the help they can to those people, but at the same time, making sure that we can get to the cases that we can to go forward. So, like I said, the many different things that we do, right now, though, the cutting-edge stuff is drug-endangered children. That has really not been done by a lot of prosecutors' offices in America right now. I spoke nationally at a national event last year. We continue to do that, and that and the opiates, I think, are the two biggest things that we deal with.
I have to ask you this question, because I asked an individual who was running for office. One of your former colleagues, while serving as a district attorney, decriminalized certain offenses, such as shoplifting, drug possession, wanton, malicious destruction of property. There's a list here. Driving with a suspended or revoked license, resisting arrest. Is that a trend we're starting to see around the Commonwealth, or is that just one specific case that district attorney felt as though those were overwhelming crimes that they were better served looking at other crimes that were higher probabilities?
Well, I mean, I think that's really the direction of the progressive DAs, of which probably across America there's probably 45 to 50 of them that are in office of the 2,400 elected. So, I mean, to me, that's the wrong philosophy.
Okay.
It doesn't work, first of all. I mean, we have a responsibility. Every time that I become district attorney, every 4 years when I get sworn in, I take an oath to uphold the Constitution, Declaration of Rights here in Massachusetts. My job is not to write laws. My job is not to take my personal opinion and change the laws. My job is to look at the laws. So therefore, what we should be doing and what we've done in our county forever is we look at the offenders, not the offenses. I mean, one of the crimes that they don't charge is distribution of Class B. Distribution. That's dealing drugs.
Right.
It makes no sense whatsoever. And to me, when you look at other cities that have gone down that path, look at San Francisco, the most liberal city in the most liberal state, even more liberal than Massachusetts.
Right.
They just threw out their DA after 2 years because crime was completely out of control. And if you choose not to prosecute crime, that's what you're going to get. So look at San Francisco, L.A., Portland, Seattle, Baltimore, New York, Philly. These crimes are skyrocketing right now. And here in our county, our violent crime is down 20% in the city of Brockton from 2015 to 2020 and 21. It still continues to go down. Our larcenies are down 47%. Our juvenile cases are down 48%. The incarceration rate of people doing time in Plymouth County House of Corrections is down 79%. DOC is down another 40-some-odd percent. Why is that? That's because what we're doing on the front end and on the back end in the middle works. So people can do what they want, you know, in other counties. I can't control that.
Sure.
I just think that direction is wrong. I don't think it works. And you don't have to believe me. All you have to do is watch what's going on around the country.
Look at the numbers.
It doesn't work.
Interesting enough, I know that Governor Baker was trying to, he had filed a dangerousness bill.
Right.
And it seems as though it's went to committee to die.
To die, absolutely.
Give me your thoughts on a piece of legislation like that and how imperative it is that it's not going to be something that's passed this legislative session, but hopefully that it's taken up as of January 2023.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly hope that. We're looking to expand the definition because there's a lot of gaps. I mean, dangerousness hearing, what that means is a case that a person is so dangerous that we move to have them held without bail for a period of time, usually 90 days. And the way that it works, I mean, I know that the legislators seem to think the DAs can just wave a magic wand. We have to have a hearing,
sure.
You know, in front of a judge. The judge has to make the call, not me, not the defense attorney. That's the way 90% of our things work, is that we have, it's an adversarial position of each other. We go in, fight our best for our respective clients, whether it be the Commonwealth or the defendant. So, you know, you go there, do your job, but it's really frustrating to me. When I know the governor had gone around the state and had conversations with the victims of domestic violence, victims of child abuse, and a lot of the child sex crimes are not there. And I know that some people have said that, oh, no, we need to look at the empirical data. I'll tell you this. I don't need any empirical data to look at when a 10-year-old girl's been raped. I'm looking at it right there.
Right.
And that person, to me, if somebody has chosen to do that, that person needs to be held, period. And that's, you know, part of our frustration, cutting off GPS equipment, you know, which is not a felony. So it's malicious injury, malicious destruction of property under $250. I mean, so it's completely, there's no teeth to that stuff. And at the same time, you know, there's lots of other legislation that we need to do, wiretaps and things such as that, which I testified for this year. Of course, that hasn't worked either. The wiretap statute was enacted in 1968. It hasn't been changed since then. Neil Armstrong walked on the moon in 1969. I think things have changed.
They have changed. District Attorney, we're plumb out of time. We could have you here for another 40 minutes, honestly. If folks want to find out more about you, your campaign for re-election, how can they do that?
Well, they can certainly go on our website, datimcruz.com, and look at all the things that we're doing on there and all the endorsements that we have from law enforcement, fire, labor, the people that understand that the job's getting done right here in Plymouth County. You know, and also anytime, you can certainly, I'm all over the place. Come talk to me, ask me, call our campaign. We're certainly willing to talk and talk about what we've done and how we've been able to make sure that Plymouth County remains in the 99th percentile of the safest counties in America.
Let's have you back in after the primer just to reshare the message and the discussion as to your reelection campaign.
Look forward to it.
You got it. He is Plymouth County DA Tim Cruz. He has been our guest. We're going to step aside just for a moment. But when we come back, more Monday Night Talk right here on 95.9 WATD.
Is Monday Night Talk with your host Kevin Tachi on 95.9 WATD. Invest your time in listening to Cape Retirement Radio and learn a smarter approach to investing so you can protect your future. Cape Retirement Radio featuring Chris Letond Thursday nights at 6:15 and Sunday mornings at 10 on 95.9 WATD. This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
We're back. We're expecting to chat with the one and only John Keenan, state senator, as we have a chance to chat with him about what's going on, what's shaking. As Matt is bringing him in, there's so many personalities and so many voices. Senator, right up to the microphone. You can take this one right here. How are you? You look refreshed. You look relaxed, almost like somebody who has had a chance to go after a long, long legislative session.
Yeah, it took a day or two to do that, but looks can be deceiving. We're right back at it, trying to get the work done, trying to wrap up some things over the course of the next several months legislatively. So it's been busy, but it is a bit of a change of pace.
How are you?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
What's new? Anything?
No, just getting over the end of the formal legislative sessions and planning strategy for the next several months where we will be in informal sessions. Still have some bills that I'm anxious to work on and to get passed if possible.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. I believe that you are the vice chairman of the Joint Committee on Transportation.
I am, yes.
I'm sure people have approached you and said, shaking their fists, what is up with the MBTA commuter rail? We got the shutdown of the Green Line, followed by the Orange in a couple of weeks. What are you hearing?
I'm hearing a lot of different things. People mostly are frustrated. That's the number one thing that I'm hearing. You know, I represent a district that relies heavily on public transportation, whether it be commuter rail, bus network, or the Red Line, and the frustration is there. I would tell you, I'm a regular MBTA Red Line rider, and I share that frustration. And it seems like over the last few weeks, if there's any news relative to the T, it's bad news. But I've been riding the T my entire life. I've always felt safe. I'm confident that it's safe, but we've got to do a better job, clearly, of getting to the root of what's going on. We had a Transportation Oversight Committee hearing just a couple weeks ago where we had the Secretary of Transportation and the MBTA General Manager in, and we questioned them in some great detail about what's going on and trying to get a sense of what's needed moving forward.
Now, have you had a chance to ride whether it's the Metro down in D.C., have you been on the New York Transit?
Wherever I go, I make a point of riding transportation. I was just up in Toronto for a couple of days of a mix of work and just a little bit of getaway. And over the course of those couple of days, I went out of my way to make sure that I rode their trolley system, their subway system, their ferries that they have in the harbor, and to ride even their blue bike program that they have up there. So I enjoy utilizing public transportation, and wherever I go, I always look to see what they're doing, whether they're doing it better, differently, trying to get a sense of what we can do here in Massachusetts.
Not to go off topic, but I actually went to Montreal a few weeks ago myself and actually did an electric bike tour.
Yes.
And it was fascinating. Seeing old Montreal is amazing. What was the best part of your trip?
The best part of my trip was the day that I didn't have anything planned, where I got one of the blue bikes, or their version of a blue bike, rode out to a neighborhood that was about 5 miles outside the downtown, walked through that neighborhood, and then utilized the trolley system and the subway to visit other neighborhoods just to kind of get away by myself, walk through the neighborhoods, use public transportation. I just found that it was a complete escape, which was nice.
So, Nelson. So, as vice chair of the Joint Committee on Transportation, with a little bit of oversight on the T, short of clicking your heels together three times and praying for a couple of Hail Marys, how do you think the T ultimately gets fixed?
I think the T ultimately gets fixed by changing the culture. We have invested recently millions and millions of dollars. And even in this most recent version of the budget, we have put aside money to ensure that safety measures and recommendations offered by the federal government or suggested by the federal government are implemented. We have, over the past couple of years, really spent a lot of money on the T, or put money in place for it. That is an effort to make up for lack of funding in the years preceding. I remember when I first got in the legislature, there was a transportation bond bill, and there was discussion about whether it should be $1 billion or $600 million. As a new legislator, I said, you know, my district relies heavily. I will vote for the higher amount. But there's politics. People from Western Mass don't rely on public transportation as much, so you've got to find that balance. But we've invested millions of dollars. I think that what needs to be changed, and this is what I asked the general manager and the secretary of transportation about, was the safety culture at the MBTA. Just a quick example, they have an anonymous safety tip hotline that employees can use if they notice something wrong relative to safety. To me, that you have to rely on an anonymous safety tip hotline means that the culture in the organization is such that employees who spot safety issues are hesitant to raise them to supervisors. And so instead of an employee seeing something wrong from a safety perspective and saying, I'm going to call the anonymous tip hotline because I don't want to get in trouble, that employee should be working in a culture where the employee raises his or her hand and says, there's a safety issue here, and the supervisors say, nice pickup, good job, let's get on that. And I know this tip hotline is kind of a transition to that, but I think that to me is representative of the culture. People should be empowered to raise safety issues when they see them, and not fear retribution, but instead be recognized for raising their hand and doing the right thing. And I think that there's a movement towards that in the MBTA. It has to happen more quickly. I know in talking to employees, they can't wait for that day. They see issues, they raise their hand, they want to be able to raise their hand and know that the issue will be addressed.
Sounds like a good bet to me. Also sounds like a good segue. I guess we're going to have sports betting here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Give your thoughts on this. The late hours that were put in to have this legislation finally pass.
But yes, there were late hours put into it, which is unfortunate that it had to go to the last minute, as so many other bills did. But the main sticking point was whether to allow betting on college sports where the colleges are located in Massachusetts. And many other states have adopted the compromise of not permitting in a state betting on an in-state college game. And so the compromise that was reached after hours of negotiation was that Massachusetts, you cannot bet on college games of colleges based in Massachusetts unless they're in things like the Final Four or in one of the bowl games. Then you can bet on those colleges. But week to week, you cannot bet on college athletics here in Massachusetts if you're a Massachusetts resident. You can bet on out-of-state college sports, but not on sports here in Massachusetts. And then there was, you know, some discussion about whether slot parlors should get X number of licenses, whether there should be independent licenses, right, and what the tax rate may be. But ultimately, it was all worked out. We'll have sports betting. It's unclear right now when people will be able to bet on sports here in Massachusetts. But the expectation is that, you know, it's going to happen. It may happen late fall, early next year. It remains to be seen, but it's coming.
How much revenue do you think the state might see from that, and how is that going to go towards the general budget?
I believe it's going to kind of follow some of the gambling revenue that comes in through our other gambling sources. And the estimates range from $25 million, I think, up to $60 million, which is a lot of money. But in the scheme of a $52 billion state budget, it's not that much money. But we were facing a situation where residents of Massachusetts were doing this and betting out of state through different channels. So this will legalize it and allow Massachusetts to capture that revenue. And that revenue will be used to fund certain things in terms of what the regular gambling does in terms of education and gambling prevention in terms of people who may become addicted to gambling, those types of things.
So it sounds like the evolution of the casino bill that was passed. This was just, you know, almost like an amendment that you kind of add this.
That's true. That is kind of what it was. It was adding an additional
component
to the gaming legislation that we had, and adding that revenue to the pool of money that we're getting from our casinos.
So the other good news was that the fiscal year 23 budget finally was passed.
Yes, about $52.7 billion of spending here in Massachusetts, which is a lot of money. Massachusetts has been fortunate that over the last couple of years, revenues have been strong despite the COVID situation. And it really gave us an opportunity to do some serious investing in the Commonwealth. One of the things that this budget's done is raised our stabilization fund, and it'll be close to $7 billion at least, which is the largest stabilization fund we've ever had. That's money that we have in reserve for a rainy day. But it's also important because bonding agencies that look at our finances, and when they determine what rates our bond will sell for, they look at our fiscal health, and stabilization account balances are an important part of that. So having that money in reserve will allow us to bond our streets and roadwork repair, our bridges, our schools, all those types of things at lower rates in the long term, saving the taxpayers of the Commonwealth millions and billions of dollars, depending how far out you go on it.
I would ask this, and it's good to hear that revenues are doing well. Wouldn't you say that if it wasn't for the stabilization fund, you know, we could this state could have been in a world of hurt in 2020 when we saw the pandemic first rear its ugly head?
Yeah, absolutely true. We drew on that stabilization fund, and then when the federal money came in and the economy started to rebound, we were able to replenish it. But had we not been able to do that, the consequences of the COVID, the impacts would have been much more severe than what they were. We were able to get through them and to come out on the other side in much better shape than we were when we went into COVID.
Any concern amongst the folks in the legislature, not from you specifically, about any stall in the economic, in the economy itself, in the economics?
There is concern. There's a lot of mixed messages out there. Unemployment nationwide and here in Massachusetts, it's very low. The rate of unemployment, you know, it's at a 50-year low. So people are working. We've seen increases in wages, and so withholding taxes on those wages will be higher. But we also are seeing the signals that the country could be on the verge of a recession. We're not certain. But even without using the R word, recession, we know that the revenues...
I stayed away from that on purpose.
Yes, the revenues that we have gotten the last couple of years are not sustainable. We expect that there'll be a decrease in revenue that we will return at best to kind of a more traditional annual increase in revenue year over year, and at worst, something that brings us down, you know, too close to a zero. But it'll likely be somewhere in between, but we're preparing for that.
Mr. Nelson.
We've seen the last couple of years through the pandemic, these big federal grant packages, the CARES Act, ARPA, that have contributed a lot of money to the state and various municipalities. How is the impact of the end of those as soon as the feds are done distributing that money? How is that going to affect the state and its monetary situation?
It will have an impact. We have worked very hard to use those revenues for one-time expenditures, not for recurring expenses. And so that when that money dries up, that we are not relying on it for you know, something going forward. It's been like paying cash for a car rather than financing it. You pay it up front, and you know that you know if the money disappears, you've got that asset, rather than financing it with one-time revenue, and 2 years later, you're like, well, that money's gone, but I still owe the note. So we've tried to focus on one-time revenues. Where it's going to have, I think, a fairly evident impact, and we're trying to plug the hole, is on funding for the MBTA. We have committed substantial federal funding to the MBTA, and we expect at the end of fiscal year 2023 into 2024 that there will be a significant drop-off in funding for the MBTA. That's matched also with decreased revenues because it's not being utilized as much as it was prior to COVID. So that's one area where it's going to be a pretty obvious impact. We've tried to plug that hole with appropriations through our budget with recurring appropriations, knowing that the MBTA is a recurring expense, but that's an area. We've spent millions and millions of dollars on keeping people in their homes during COVID, helping them with rental assistance or with mortgage payments and when they've had difficulties. That has worked to keep people in their homes. And while rentals and home prices are still astronomically high here, we think we've gotten over that bump, and that one-time commitment of federal resources seems to have worked, and we're hopeful that we return to somewhat of a more normal, as concerning as the market is, but a more normal situation that involves relative to evictions and foreclosures.
Just got a couple of minutes left here. Anything that we haven't touched upon, but while you're here, you want to maybe share some news, whether it's worthy of the district or that you've been able to secure?
Yeah, so we in the budget, we were able to get some local priorities funded. Mostly those are general in terms of streets and sidewalks. And in the economic development bill, we were able to get some resources committed to our communities. But the economic development bill is now stalled. So we're going to continue to do that. Local aid for our schools, public schools, including our vocational technical schools, our special education schools, we've been able to fund at record levels. Unrestricted general government aid, which cities and towns and the towns in my district use for police and fire and veterans and libraries and seniors. Those are at historic levels. In particular, the Senate really increased the amount of money that will go to cities and towns for those types of programs. So we continue to work on those things, knowing how important they are to our local governments and how important our local government work is to the citizens of the communities.
Probably the last thing I'll ask you, and that is if there's any constituents who want to reach out to your office for assistance, or somebody wants to find out more about you being reelected so you can get back in office in 2023.
Sure. Most importantly for constituents, and you asked me this question a while back, and I struggled with the phone number, but the office phone number is 617-722-1494. Any constituent that has a concern or an issue of any sort, we're happy to help out, and I have a great crew that does phenomenal work in that respect. And then in terms of campaign, KeenanForSenate.com, they can link to an email address that then can contact the campaign in that respect. But any constituent, please call us at the office at 722-1494, area code 617.
Matt, you get the last question.
Last question, another hot-button issue, pun intended, is wildfires, brush fires, and specifically the water crisis. If you could quickly touch on that, and I know you can't change the weather for us, but what the legislature can do to kind of help the towns and cities deal with the water crisis.
Right, so we can help them in terms of the immediate with funding that helps them. We've also helped them in terms of drinking water with some PFAS remediation funding. And in the bigger picture, we have passed a very comprehensive climate bill. And I know that's not something that's going to give us more water tomorrow, but in the long term, hopefully it will provide us with relief from what's happening in terms of climate change. But we continue to focus on the quality of water throughout my district in particular, and the supply. And the supply is more of a challenge than the quality. The quality we can address with filters and funding and things like that, but the supply is really up to Mother Nature.
All right. Well, we thank you so much for joining us, and we thank you for being a regular part of the rotation. We look forward to having you in probably sometime after Labor Day to give us an update as to how things are going out on the campaign trail.
Great. I'd love it. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Oh, my goodness, Matt. That's it for hour number one. It's in the books.
Unbelievable. That was a fast hour.
It goes fast. Hour number two, straight ahead. You are tuned in to Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD. Stay tuned.
Previous episodes of Monday Night Talk and listen to them anywhere. Check out 959watd.com/Monday Night Talk. And now, more Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk, hour number two. Later this hour, of course, we will have the great Jerry Thornton, best-selling book author, also writes about the Patriots for Barstool Sports. So we'll have him joining us, and we'll get some insight into the Patriots and their training camp. Of course, alongside all evening has been Matt Mad Dog Nelson. My name is Kevin Tachi, and this segment we're actually going to talk a little bit about Title IX. Matt, how much do you know about Title IX?
Well, it went into effect before I was born, so I'm able to reap the rewards of it, but I don't know too much about what life was like before Title IX.
So we are fortunate to have joining us on the phone line is somebody who had to deal with Title IX, not only as someone who was a player herself, but also a coach. We know that Title IX is celebrating, this is legislation, celebrating its 50th year of being enacted. And it's the idea of having equality when it comes to sports, regardless of your gender, that there's equality and that there's a fairness to it. Now, there are some folks who will tell you that we haven't seen full equality, and that as of recently, we're starting to see the fruits of the labor to make sure that both male and female athletes are paid somewhat equally, that there's not a major imbalance. We have Mary. Well, her maiden name was Mary Lee, unless that was her previously married name. She's Mary Watson. Hi, Mary. How are you?
I'm fine. My maiden name was Duggan, Mary Duggan.
Mary Duggan. And so Lee was your
first husband.
Your first husband. Okay. And yeah. I only know this because we're actually there's an ongoing project, the Abington girls basketball team, the 80-81 basketball team, actually made it to the championship. And Mary is the voice of the semifinal game as the Green Wave was able to overcome all odds to make it to the big game. But Mary, if I could, tell us, for folks who don't know, You're a Hall of Fame. You've been inducted into the Massachusetts Hall of Fame. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And now, is that as a player or as an outstanding coach?
As a coach. I've been inducted into 5 different Hall of Fames for various reasons and that. And $3 will get you a cup of coffee at Dunkin' Donuts. So as a player and a coach, both in different ones, high school, college, et cetera, et cetera. But the biggest one, the Massachusetts one that I really hold tight to is basically for the work that I initiated in getting equal rights for high school players in the at Rockland High School, which also had a ripple effect on all the high schools in the area. So,
did you ever imagine when you started with sports way back when that you would one day that female sports would be at such a place where you could even imagine being inducted into a Hall of Fame?
No, not at all. I grew up with four brothers and played sports with them since I could walk. And we would play all day. And then when, of course, Little League time came, I couldn't play because I was a girl. So I was made the automatic scorekeeper. I learned how to keep score. And that kept me in the dugout, and I would practice with them, and but I could never play in a game. Girls couldn't play Little League baseball until 1975, but I would play. And the only real outlet for girls when I was growing up in any kind of community teams or anything was the CYO. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
No.
The CYO was the Catholic Youth Organization, and of course I had the Methodist Youth Organization and the Congress, and different churches had girls' teams, and we used to play each other in softball and basketball. And the CYO, it was pretty well developed. They had teams all over the state trying to keep the girls out of trouble, and that was, but there was no school sports for a lot of girls.
So I would ask you, Mary, if there were any schools that had sports, What were the predominant sports at that time, whether it was when you were in school or as you became a coach?
When I was in high school, the public schools had, like, field hockey, just field hockey, probably often in the fall, and then basketball in the winter. And it was usually an abbreviated schedule in comparison to the boys, and then softball in the spring. You know, where the boys had multiple choices, you know, cross country, football, soccer, basketball, track and field, you know, and so on and so on and so on. So there was very little equality at all. And I graduated from high school in the Wayback Machine in 1963. Of course, I went to Cardinal Spelman, and the only varsity sport that they offered when I was there was basketball. Because the nuns didn't want us running around the fields with shorts on, so we couldn't have a softball team. So that was it. So, and of course, the boys had multiple sports, and it bothered me, and it bothered my friends who were very athletic. You know, and, our major outlet was CYO.
Matt,
and then through,
go ahead.
Yes,
and then through. Go ahead.
And then through college, when I went to college at Bridgewater State, I ran into the same thing. The only varsity sport they had offered, believe it or not, from 64 to 67 for girls at Bridgewater State was team sport, was basketball. And it was also was very abbreviated. We even had a drive to our own games. You know, the boys had a bus, and I mean, we had to drive to our own games and wash our own uniform. You know, we had to do everything. You know, you had to want to play, you know. And it was very, very unfair. And then very unequal. And then when I graduated from Bridgewater, I went on my way and kind of just, I played on a traveling, touring softball team called the Waltham Drifters, who were very good. So that kept me, you know, occupied and kept me from going crazy for a few years.
Tell us,
and then I ended, yeah.
Tell us what living through the implementation, so the laws passed, what happens next? Take us through that experience of living through the law actually going into effect and being implemented.
Well, I had just finished my first year at Rockland, and we did very well. The boys team had won the state championship, so they were riding very high, and they were very good, and I really enjoyed watching them, and I enjoyed the coach, and I enjoyed the players. I had them in class and everything. But the girls team, we had the gym from 2 to 2:45 every day. And of course, school got out at 2, so by the time they got changed and down there, it was 2:15, 2:20. And the boys had it from 4 till 9 every afternoon. So it was still very unequal. And then it was 72, 73, and I started reading about this Title IX. And I had a friend, Dr. Sally Rudisell, who was the first female orthopedic surgeon to graduate from Yale University, who was very into it, and she was in my ear about doing something. You got to do something, Mary. You got to do something at that school. So what I, you know, like it was still very unfair, and we had I don't know if you can remember, if you anybody might remember this, we had these uniforms called tunics, which were like kilts with tops, and they were just totally inappropriate for playing basketball. So myself and another coach, we went out and bought our own shirts and shorts with numbers on it, and we didn't tell the principal. Of course, he was a little bit upset. But anyway, I went to him and I said, you know, this just isn't fair. And I said, you know, I've got some players that I can develop into really good players. And this was like 73, and at that time, girls weren't being offered scholarships to college or anything like that. It was just beginning to open up a little bit. And he said, you know, he looked at me like I had, you know, four heads. And so I said, I just want a little more time. I really, Kevin, I wasn't interested in the money or the politics. I just want a little more gym time to work with the kids.
Right.
And so they just kind of said, you know, you're out of your mind.
Mary, I got to ask you, and I want to actually digress for half a second, because my understanding, not only were there limitations on the available sports, but I believe like a sport like basketball was even different for girls compared to boys. Where and Matt Nelson and I have actually sat through and heard discussions, roundtable discussions, and seen presentations as to how different it was for women, for girls to be able to play sports, and how they changed the rules. Like, you know, you were able to, when it came to basketball, you were able to have a couple players that were up, but you had a couple of other players could not breach half court. I mean, was that what was going on with the sports back prior to Title IX?
When I was in high school and in college, it changed when I was in college. When I was in high school, you had 3-on-3. You had 6 players on the team. You had 3 forwards, 3 guards. Yep, you couldn't go across. They couldn't go across the half-court line. And it was, you know, and then they introduced the fact that you could have rovers. You could have one from each side that could go, so you ended up having like 4-on-4. It was ridiculous, and it really was. And then in 1970-71, they turned it into the 5-man game that the boys played, you know, just because it didn't make any sense. And so they started playing the regular 5-man basketball in like 71 in this state. In some states like Iowa and everything, they played the 6-man game half court up well into the 80s. But in Massachusetts, they went to the 5-man game, which made it, like, for the coaches and everything, you know. And there were no men coaching girls' teams. It was unheard of. You did not have men. Like, I know you, Dick Kelly took over at Abington in, like, 78. Up until that time, you had no men coaching girls' teams. It was all women.
Now, can I back up to Dick Kelly real quick? What was the story behind Dick Kelly? Because my understanding was that maybe there should have been a girl coach, and that there were folks that felt that there was a story behind that prior to him taking over, that, you know, maybe he shouldn't have been the coach, or he didn't deserve to be the coach, and that you might have even had a word to say about, you know, whether he was worthy to coach.
He was a great coach.
But that's what I'm saying is that you weren't against seeing him be a girls' coach, but people were feeling as though that he shouldn't have been. Am I wrong?
Yeah, up until Title IX and equal pay, and men weren't interested in coaching girls' teams. You know, and up until they turned it into the boys' game, men weren't interested. And administration really didn't want to hire men to coach girls' team because of, you know, locker room situations and stuff like that. You know, but Dick Kelly was one of the first ones in this area to coach, and he was a very good coach. And Jim Daly, who passed away recently, he was a coach at Whitman Hanson. I think he started in, like, 79 or 80. He was another one, but it was very rare. There was, when I started coaching at Rockland High, there were no men at any level coaching girls' sports in this area. So you know, it was all women, and they were women sometimes from the school. And to be honest with you, some of them, you know, the social studies teachers had played a little in high school, and they really weren't that well equipped to coach a team. Especially the five-man boys style, so it was a difficult transition because of all that was going on in the transition of the game and the reluctance of the administration to hire men for a girls' team, you know, for various reasons. And now it's really wonderful now the way it's worked out. But the first year that I asked for equal time, one of the men actually at the meeting, one of the coaches actually at the meeting, stood up, picked up his chair, turned the chair around, and faced the wall because he didn't want to hear what I was saying.
Goodness. Again, if you're just tuning in, you are tuned into Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD. Kevin Tocci and Matt Nelson on the microphones with Mary Duggan, Mary Watson, and she's a Massachusetts Hall of Fame coach. And we're talking about Title IX, the equality 50-year anniversary. As time is ticking down, I can't believe this. We're already halfway through this conversation. Matt, you had a question, and I also want to make sure that folks know Matt is probably one of the best play-by-play folks in the area when it comes to calling basketball, football, hockey, baseball, softball. I can only imagine what it would have been like for you if you had a different set of rules, not only for the boys, but for the girls, and then through its growing process. Do you have a question for Mary?
I couldn't imagine having to learn ultimately what would be 40 or 50 different sports at that point between the men and the women.
Yeah.
But Mary, I wanted to ask, every once in a while we see Title IX pop up in the news, particularly at the college level. One of the most recent ones was the March Madness weight room scandal, where the woman down in San Antonio had one set of dumbbells and the men in Indianapolis had this state-of-the-art, almost NFL professional team looking weight room with the treadmills and ellipticals and weights and all this other stuff. What do you think still needs to be done to prevent situations like that from still happening at this day and age?
Well, I mean, there's no excuse for it except for, like, you know, it's a big slap in the, you know, that they have so many wealthy, you know, alumni that they could, you know, circumvent, like, you know, federal and tax dollars and everything and donate, you know, a good weight room for the girls, you know, for the women, you know. But a lot of the women coaches, you know, have got to the point where, like, you know, we'll make do. You know, if you talk to Gino Auriemma, I mean, he used to, like, when he first started coaching at UConn, he had to take home all the uniforms and his wife and him washed them, you know. And, you know, I mean, here's a guy who's won how many national championships, you know, bringing home uniforms and washing them. When the boys had all theirs done by, you know, volunteers and by the Boosters Club and all this stuff, you know, it's been going on for years. But, you know, some people just feel like, you know, the boys is a better game, and they play harder and better, and, you know, and, you know, the good old boys club, I guess. But to me, it doesn't bother me that much, that because I've seen progress throughout my years. The fact that I have, you know, I can walk in and say, look, I want the gym for 3 hours. The boys have it for 3 hours. I want it for 3 hours. And I don't care what you pay me or what uniforms you give me or what equipment you give me. You know, I can, you know, I can do this with, you know, the time to develop the players. And with the extra time, you see all these girls that are so great. In 75, we had our first at Rockland. First girl win a full scholarship to college, and so we're two years away from getting equal time. And then 78, we had two. Dick Kelly can tell you that this Trisha Cochran that played against them, he'll tell you, probably the best player he ever saw. She played for me. And then in 81, I had three more girls that won full scholarships to college. You know, and I mean, and it was just they got the time, they got the instruction. You know, they started doing summer camps for girls, which was pretty much unheard of. All of a sudden, summer basketball camps started popping up for girls and everything. So all these different things started happening. And a lot of the pioneers that were involved in this Title IX stuff didn't really care too much about, like, you know, we can make do with the equipment we have. We can make do with what we have. We can improvise. We just need time to develop players. And that was our big thing, is getting the equal time. Of course, you know, when I got that retroactive equal check, that didn't hurt either at all.
And again, we're speaking with Mary Watson, formerly Mary Duggan. And you know, I got to ask is who are some of the folks who are still around, some of the other leading women in the area that you remember, and maybe you still see or talk to these days, that, you know, lived through these, you know, the days before Title IX, and even during the slow progress of Title IX once it was implemented. Is there anybody that you can remember that you may still talk to or see that were trailblazers in these efforts?
Unfortunately, most of them have passed, the women. And then, you know, the men that I know, like, you know, well, Jimmy Daly just met Dick Kelly. He went through it as on the male side, but profited greatly with his girls' team. Paula Sullivan went through it. She was the head coach at Stonehill College from 73 until the 90s and won over 900 college games. She was also the athletic director at Stonehill College. She went through that. When she started at Stonehill College, all she had was an intramural team. And by the mid-70s, mid-80s, she was winning the Northeast 10 championship and came one game away from winning the national championship. So she went through all that. She actually lives in Abington. Her name is Paula Sullivan. She actually lives in Abington. And the other ones that I know are Scott McKinley, who was the principal at Rockland High, who was adamantly opposed to my request when I first walked into his office. We eventually became very good friends, and he said, you were right. You know, you were right. You were right about, you know, girls and women having these opportunities, and he became a big fan of ours. Some of the other coaches, not so much, the many coaches. Ken Owens, I don't know if you know who Ken Owens is. He was the head football coach at Rockland High for years. He was a great supporter of mine, and came to games, and he, you know, he lost a couple of coaches because of it. I mean, the football coach had like eight coaches, and, you know, he had to lose six of them to pay for our extra time and uniforms and everything. But actually, he was a great supporter. But of women, besides Paula, and this Dr. Sally Rudisell, who was a trailblazer in women's sports and in women medicine, there's not too many of them left, Kevin. They're pretty much dropping by the wayside. So, There were some women who were not on board with me either. They liked it the way it was. They didn't want to.
Rock the boat.
Right. They didn't want to cause ripples. They were happy to coach their hour and a half in the afternoon and go home, and teach their classes. Yeah, there was some, and I was amazed when I approached some women about getting together and really fighting this. I was amazed at the ones who just kind of said, like, no, I'm not going to do that. I was amazed. I was absolutely amazed.
Mary, we got 2 minutes left. And I was going to give the last question to Matt, but Matt will get the next question when we speak with our next guest, Jerry Thornton, in a few moments. We want to thank you so much for joining us. Anything that you want to say, and again, I got 2 minutes, I'm up against the clock. Anything you want to say in closing in regards to Title IX and where it stands today and where you hope it'll be in the next 5 to 10 years?
I think it's great. I think a lot of, I mean, the naysayers, they're just going to have to live with it, Kevin. They're going to have to suck it up, I think it's great. I see little girls playing, AAU softball. My granddaughter's playing our summer league, which I never had, and it's the greatest thing in the world for her because she has cystic fibrosis, and she's out there exercises, and her lungs are great, and these kids are playing all summer, and they're having a great time, and they're socializing, they're getting off those tablets, and, they have all sorts of teams, and in the fall, same thing, they have all sorts of choices. She has, my granddaughter's going into junior high, and she's got, like, 4 different choices of what she wants to pick athletically.
Nice.
And I just think it's wonderful, and I think it's all because of Title IX. There's plenty enough around here to share. People just have to learn how to share and play nice.
Yeah, well, they have to learn how to merge, too, but that's another story for another day. Mary, I want to thank you so much for joining me, and we definitely should have you back on for more conversation, because I think we just scratched the surface when it comes to Title IX and what folks had to endure. So until our next conversation, I thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you.
There she is. Mary Watson, talking about Title IX.
Mary Duggan Lee Watson.
Yeah, what she said. Mary Duggan Lee Watson, our guest. It's an awful lot of hyphens. We're going to step aside, and when we come back, more Monday Night Talk. The great Jerry Thornton joins us in just a moment. Stay tuned.
Is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
I'm Tiny of Tiny & Sons Glass. My boys do a good job. Here's why. When they were kids, every summer we'd go to the automotive graveyard and take cars apart. Windshields, transmissions, generators. Then comes the fun part, putting it all back together. It was summer camp at the junkyard. And it worked. They're good boys. You can trust them.
My dad did a great job. 1-888-64-TINY. Just call.
When you think about a business you like, what sticks in your mind? They're efficient, everything looks professional, and they're timely. You don't need an entire marketing staff to have that for your business. You just need to contact WePrint Today. Printing and copies are just the beginning. WePrint Today offers professional engineering copies, scanning, emailing, fax service, UPS shipping, mailing services, rubber stamps, signs, banners, posters, and much more. Give your storefront a facelift with new posters from WePrint Today. Reach your customers directly with WePrint Today's mailing services. Promote your event with flyers, brochures, signs, and banners. Clean up your office space and take advantage of WePrint Today's secure document shredding. When your business needs it done quickly and professionally, call WePrint Today at 1-800-WPT-FAST or visit them online at WePrintToday.com. WePrint Today, 66 Summer Street, Route 3A in Kingston. WePrint Today, because tomorrow may be too late.
Plymouth County is a large area stretching from just south of Boston down to the Cape Cod Canal. I'm Alex Bazanson. Join me and my guests for countywide coverage, everything from the Mayflower Landing to the most recent town meetings, how national news affects us locally, and how things that happen in Plymouth County affect the rest of the South Shore. Tune in for All About Plymouth County, tomorrow night at 7 here on 95.9 WATD.
Be a part of the show. Call in and join in on the conversation. 781-837-4900. Now, back to Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
All right, we return for the final segment of Monday Night Talk. Of course, this show fondly named Tachi and the Mad Dog. Matt Nelson in as my special co-host as the latter part of the show. I mean, I had to subject him to, you know, the political talk, and he made it through okay. I thought he was going to keel over right around 6:50, but he persevered. He pushed through for the good parts. Great conversation with Mary Duggan Lee Watson, great title name conversation. Now we can talk with the great Jerry Thornton, who is a book author, writer for Barstool Sports, and much, much more. Jerry, how are you?
I'm good. A tough act to follow, by the way. Mary Duggan Lee Watson, the notorious MDLW. She's a tough act to follow. What a sweet lady. And you know what? And she's right. You didn't bring me here to be sincere, but you know, hearing her talk about how gratified she is that her granddaughter is doing sports, and you know, in a way that maybe wouldn't be denied to her. And you know, I raised two kids through, you know, combined like 12 years of football, youth football. Actually, more, because one played all the way through senior year of high school and everything. And it was the best thing that ever happened to them. You know what I mean? And I loved when she said, put away the screens and the tablets or whatever. And yeah, more women in sports is great, as long as they're being paid 78% of what the men are, right? I mean, we're all with that, right, guys? This isn't Sweden. No, I'm kidding. That's a joke, everyone. Don't save your letters. I figure anyone who's mad at that probably sends letters and not emails. But
I have to ask you, I always love the, you know, in between segments and the chit chat, and we were talking beers, and interesting enough, you know, you had mentioned about Stellwagen, which is just right down the way. Yeah. And the daunting question is, how come they haven't developed a Six Rings specialty beer for Jerry Thornton?
Oh, there we go. Tie it in with my book. That would be fine. The only thing they've ever done for me is had me headline their comedy show last...
You do with Christine Hurley?
Christine Hurley headlined the month before me.
Yep.
Chrissy Judge, who's a great friend, and she's a Marshfield native, and she's great. And it was had a really nice time there. By all means, you should check it out. They do, you know, they'll post it on their website what the next shows are and what the next headliner is. But it was fun. They call it Hoppy Hour.
But see,
their pun game is really strong.
But see, I'm thinking here, if they're looking for puns, right? Why not From Darkness to Dynasty? You know, a double IPA.
Oh, yeah, or a dark beer and call it From Darkness to Dynasty.
Yes,
that would be fine.
I can see the launch now: a book signing and beer launch with Jerry Thornton.
Let's do it. Stellwagen, get on it. Everyone, please go there, and you know, I'll buy you one if you say hi that you heard me on WATD. It's on me.
Let's you know. So the real reason we got you here is we are big Pats fans, and we know you're somebody who is also a big Patriots fan. So it's kind of a Patriots love-in. But you've had a front seat as of late to see training camp.
Absolutely. You know what? Those sentences that begin with "the reason we brought you here" never work out that well. So I'm great. Just know that no grave can hold me. I've been to camp. Well, they've had 8 practices. I've been to 4 of them. Been to both the you know, 2 padded sessions, which is a big deal. And it's you know, it's been a mixed bag. It's been up and down. They're definitely a work in progress. But I love going there. It's great to hang out in the media tent and talk to guys whose content I was reading long before I ever started drawing a paycheck doing this stuff. And I would go down to camp just for the fun of it. And, you know, I always make it a point to walk through the fans who, you know, are in the same stands I used to take my kids to and whatever, and interact with them. And the crowds have been huge. You know, it was funny because last year, the first time, you remember 2020, they didn't allow anybody in there, which was just surreal. You know, there's a psychological phenomenon known as kinopsia, which is empty seeing. It's that weird feeling you get from being somewhere that's empty that used to be full, like an abandoned warehouse or an old, like, you know, rundown mall or city block that no one lives in anymore. And it was uncanny. Well, this year, last year you go, and they had a crowd that was about 75% capacity. And the guys on 98.5, you know, all the haters like, oh, it's the Tom Brady effect. No one cares about football anymore. No, it was called a day of torrential downpours, you knuckleheads. Like, they go, you go there on a Saturday and they're turning people away. This team hasn't lost a beat in terms of fan interest just because the GOAT is now down in Tampa.
Well, you know, it's funny. Now, I'm trying not to transition here too prematurely, but has he become the tainted GOAT after the recent news about Miami?
Oh, you know what? He ought to be. And I don't begrudge a guy talking to another team, but there's a rule against tampering for a reason. And the fact that he couldn't have told, you know, Miami ownership, you know what? I'll tell you. Once the season's over, then let's talk. You know, in March, I'll announce that I'm leaving New England, and then we'll work out a deal. It's not hard to do. But we find out now that he was talking to them throughout the 2019 season, where he was walking around with a disagreeable puss on his face the entire time. You know, now we know just how disgruntled he was. And if you think that had no factor in all of this, then let me remind you that they went into the final game 12-3, needing to just win to secure a playoff bye week. There were 17.5-point favorites going into that game. And who are they playing? The Miami Dolphins, whose owner and he were in substantive talks about him taking over a piece of the team. You're going to tell me that he was 100% focused on that game?
No.
And they lose, and then they play the next week, and he has one of the worst postseason games, if not the worst postseason game of his career. I don't know how much of a factor that was, but you can't tell me that it was no factor. And I'm getting more people telling me, well, you know, the team quit on him. It's all their fault. Belichick was mean to him. You know, okay, so it's open season on a guy? If Mr. Kraft is talking to Cooper Kupp next week, I'm supposed to just go, that's fine. And if it's okay with you, then why were they sneaking around about it? Why didn't they go have dinner at Davio's next to the stadium with their lawyers and stuff? Because they didn't want people to know, because it's crooked as all hell. And, yeah, he deserves whatever scorn he's getting, but I mostly save it for the Dolphins.
So before we go on the Tom Brady rant full,
sure,
let's talk Pat's training camp.
Please.
I've heard that the 11v11 needs some work, but they're excelling in the sevens.
Yeah, it's sorry to report that offensively, it's the closer it gets to actual game conditions, the more they've dominated is too strong a word, but the more that the defense has had the upper hand on them. So individual drills, sure. Jones is, you know, dialing it in. I saw him throw 40-yard in the air dimes to like five straight receivers, different guys running routes in one-on-one coverage. Then you get into 7-on-7s, and it's not quite there. Then they get into 11s, and it's been a struggle. Now, I was there Thursday, and it was a good bounce-back day for him. But still, you know, he's not having a lot of time to throw. You know, when they're in pads and the defense can actually hit, they're getting in there. They're forcing the pocket. They're coming up the middle. Christian Barmore has been terrific. So, look, it's a pick-your-poison thing. Like, if the offense was tearing them apart, there'd be that element that would say, wait, they got rid of all their linebackers from last year. They've flipped over their front seven. They've lost their best cornerback. The defense is terrible. Everybody panic. Well, okay, the defense has had the advantage. So we're going, the offense, it's a disaster. It's a huge step backwards. So, you know what? They've revamped the offense clearly. It's a different look. Looks a lot more like you'd see with Sean McVay's Rams or Kyle Shanahan's 49ers, tighter splits, a lot of motion, a lot of zone blocking, and so on. And you know what? I'll give them some time to let it shake out. Let's see how they do against the Giants in the first preseason game and joint practices, and we'll have a better idea. But for now, clearly the engine needs further tuning.
So I would ask you if you were to compare and contrast to past training camps that you've looked at, right? Is it on par where you're seeing the defenses are dominant and maybe there might be some struggles? And again, we're talking post-Tom Brady, although maybe during Tom Brady's time you saw similar traits with the team.
Yeah, it's every year and every practice can be different. I will say this, the whole vibe of Brady's probably last 2 or 3 years was reading body language. How disgruntled is he? Does he look, man, he looks like he really isn't happening. He and Belichick interacting, I always have to compare it to like a dating relationship, but it's like a couple that you can sit there and go, oh, their body language isn't really good. Look at that. They're not really facing each other. They're having conversations, like side discussions. They're not really talking to each other. And Brady was skipping OTAs. You know, if it wasn't a mandatory practice, he was out of there, and Belichick, was getting questions about that, so it was awkward. Now at least, they're 100% on the same page. It was hard not to notice, though, the first practice, the energy level among the offensive players was off the charts. Like, they're high-fiving each other, they're celebrating. I mean, the last play that they ran in that first practice, Jones hit Damian Harris at the cone. He gets into the end zone. Five teammates come over and start celebrating with him. Jones sprints 30 yards and jumps up in the air into his arms and stuff, and then they go down the backfield to run, sprints or whatever. And now it's kind of been like, I'm guessing they got spoken to in the meetings and just saying, okay, you're celebrating a lot. How about this? How about the fact that, they had one practice where they ran 10 straight plays and got kept out of the end zone and then completed a touchdown on the 11th play. And, the defense had to do push-ups, which is like
garbage.
Oh, life is unfair.
Yeah. During a heat wave.
During a heat wave, absolutely, it's been nasty down there. But you can say that they're focused, and I really think Jones is so dialed in, and like Matthew Slater said, this team is going to take on the personality of the quarterback, and so if he's not feeling it, if he's frustrated, and his performance and the guys around him is not up to par, yeah, he's showing it, and that's probably what leadership is all about,
So it seems like since I graduated high school in 2011,
Dear Lord.
The question has always been Bill Belichick as a general manager. He's a great coach, but where does he stand as a general manager?
I love the GM Bill versus HC Bill debate. My favorite is the people who alternate back and forth and just say it's not, it's, the coach has been done dirty by the GM as if, it's not all part of the same plan. Listen, he's the best general manager in football, dead stop. That's it. That's the headline. He has been for 20 years, and there's no arguing around it. Like, he hasn't just been lucky. And we all love to focus on his failures, but show me somebody who doesn't have as many failures as him. Show me. Well, the fact is, nobody has as many as him because they don't run a team for 23 straight years and have absolute control over everything. Guys get fired because they don't win as much as him. He's not just the lucky recipient of, the head coach. He is the guy who calls all the shots and gets guys who fit his system. And I imagine that you want to talk about N'Keal Harry. Sure, okay. It's the wide receiver is the hardest position in the sport to draft. It might be the hardest position in all of sports to scout. N'Keal Harry was a colossal disaster, but that's on him. He owns that. But you can't show me a guy who didn't bust out on a first round draft pick at that position, because the bust rate on that is so off the charts. And I'm not apologizing. It was a terrible mistake, but N'Keal Harry was ranked between the third or the fifth best receiver in that draft by every single draft pundit. it wasn't a shock that he went number two, where he went, you know, 32nd overall, but number two among wide receivers. Every team in the league passed on DK Metcalf twice because he was drafted 64th, even though he broke the combine. Andy Isabella from UMass was drafted before him. I guess, you know what, it's random. It's the crappiest of all crapshoots. He busted out on that, making no excuses for him. It's just that's the nature of the beast. But he's built the best roster in football for two decades now, and hopefully counting.
And let's also not forget, and I think there's still a string that's going, of undrafted free agents who sign and make the team and actually contribute. Am I wrong?
Oh, I mean, it's a consecutive streak that goes well back. And just some recent guys, Malcolm Butler.
Yep.
J.C. Jackson. You know, he didn't sign Danny Amendola, but there's a guy who had great success coming to New England, you know, as a free agent. But, you know, and this year there's some real good possibilities. There's a guy I want to put on your radar, an offensive lineman, interior offensive lineman named Drew Desjarlais, who we signed out of Canada, out of the Winnipeg Blue Bombers. Another guy named Brendan Schooler, big, tall, lanky, special teams guy, safety, who played some wide receiver. And, you know, either of those guys have an outstanding chance of keeping this streak alive. But, you know, the free agent signings that he made, I mean, you know, we can talk about GM Bill. You're right, he hasn't won an Executive of the Year award since, this year. He's the defending Executive of the Year, and I just spent 10 minutes defending how he's a good GM.
You're just tuning in. We are fortunate to have the great Jerry Thornton in studio. Of course, don't forget his two books, From Darkness to Dynasty. Of course, that's the first 40 years of the New England Patriots, and there is 5 rings, but that has been updated to 6 rings. That's the Super Bowl history of the New England Patriots, still available. I think there's still editions out there to be had, and they could probably get those on Amazon, right?
Yes, and we're also wherever books are sold.
Are you working on another book yet, or is that?
I'm waiting to really get inspired by something that's going to be, you know, that I can sink my teeth into it. Writing a book, it's like a really tough term paper. Like, if you're into the material that you're covering, it makes it so much easier. But if you're just assigned something, like, here you go, you're doing your report on Silas Marner, you know, Beowulf or something, that it's a grind. But do it on something that you're interested in, and it makes it so much easier. So, yeah, I'd like to. I hate to think that I just had the 3 books in me, but it's going to have to be something like, maybe I'll finally be the one to do Kevin Tocci, an unauthorized biography.
Nobody will read that.
Oh, no.
You would lose. Now, you're not a big guy to begin with. You would lose probably about 60 pounds chasing Mr. Tocci around.
He's got crazy amounts of energy, doesn't he?
It's insane.
Yeah. I don't know. Do you think it's artificial? Do you think he's on a little something? Or if
he might be.
His testosterone. He's just a solid ball of
hormones. The Red Bull gives him legs.
I do like the Red Bull. I am guilty. I love the Red Bull. But I have cut back on my Miralus. I was a peanut butter guy for a long time. And just to try to shed a few LBs for training camp, I've cut down on those. So.
But the peanut butter coffees?
They got, yeah. Peanut, oh, yeah. Man. We get them all the time.
Okay. No, I
that's the problem with Mary Lou's, is a lot of sugar, and they got a lot of flavors, and, you know.
And it gives you a lot of energy.
It gives you a ton of energy. Trust me, and I need it. I got to pump it right into my vein.
Yeah, you know, listen, I'm a crystal meth guy. No, I'm not. Do not do that, kids. Just say no.
Uh-oh, you better call Saul. No. Yeah. Anyways, no, did you have another question?
So believe it or not, my previous question about Belichick the GM was not to talk about N'Keal Harry and the failures.
Okay.
You mentioned Christian Barmore having a great camp.
Sure.
What are the other draft picks looking like?
Yeah, okay, starting with Tyquan Thornton. I'll go with him.
You don't want to go a little strange on this one?
Yeah, I mean, strange. Listen, you know, they've had a limited amount of you know, padded practices, obviously, so it's hard to gauge at this point. And as I mentioned earlier, they've had trouble with protection, but, you know, I think that's a good pick. And people can argue that he was overdrafted or whatever. It was an area of need. You know, we've seen with in the Brady era, when the team struggled the most, it's when that they couldn't protect the inside of the line, and that's what he's there for. Tyquan Thornton is interesting because, you know, people described him. Yeah, he's blazing speed. He's a trackly. He's also like 182 pounds. So, you know, the concern was that, you know, he's made out of, balsa wood and paste, and he was put together by a kindergarten kid. But no, I've seen him make catches, with a lot of contact. I've seen him, like, out-muscle Jawan Williams, who I'm not super high on, but he's 40 pounds bigger than Thornton, and come around and get his head around on a ball and make tough catches. You know, we haven't really seen him on big go routes or anything like that, but he's making the catches on crossing routes and over the middle and that kind of stuff. So, you know, they don't need him to be great right away, you know, because they've got a fairly crowded wide receiver room. But, you know, if he can contribute and then be their guy going forward, that'd be great. Then you got the two Joneses, Marcus and then Jack. They're getting a lot of heavy rotations at cornerback and looking solid. I mean, none of them are going to mistake anyone for Stephon Gilmore quite yet, but they're part of the rotation, and they don't look lost. They look like they have the ability to stick with a guy on double routes and changes directions, and that's really what you look for early on. Then it's a matter of when they're in a game, when the bullets are live, do they have the ability to mesh with everybody else, because the four and five guys back there all have to go together. So, yeah, so far, so good on this draft class. And then I'll just throw one more name out there. Pierre Strong Jr., the running back that they got, who, again, this team clearly, GM Bill's thoughts was, I'm sorry I was so defensive on him, because I'm just
used to
being like,
he
stinks, he doesn't know what he's doing. Yeah, he's completely lost. But, you know, clearly that they did their postseason evaluation, and they said, what do we need? And it was speed. Like Maverick and R.I.P. Goose, they clearly decided they needed to get faster, and Strong's a big part of that. Strange is a part of that, too. I mean, he's, like, as far as guards go, he's blistering. He's, like, out like a 5.05 40-yard dash or something, so I expect a lot of him getting out in front of screen passes and being pulling and all that stuff. And he started some fights in OTAs, so that's good. Yeah, I think he's going to give him that mental edge.
There's never enough time when you come in here, Jerry. I will say that is because there's so much that we can talk about. I know that a lot of the pundits these days, the one thing that they're all chirping about is the fact that Bill has not named a DC or an OC, and that you've got a couple of washout head coaches named Matt Patricia and Joe Judge who are somehow in the mix when it comes to the second year growth of Mac Jones. You've had a chance to see this firsthand. Does it look as though the offense is doing okay with this three-headed monster? Because we know Bill's in there somewhere, too.
Yeah, it's so hard to judge because you still don't know who's calling the shots. It seems like different times it's a different coach. You know, Patricia will be on the walkie-talkie, and then you see Joe Judge is in the huddle, and then, you know, Jones throws an interception, and he goes immediately over to Belichick. So I think they're figuring it out. And, yeah, that is the number one story surrounding this team throughout the entire offseason. And I just caution people who are saying this is a disaster in the making. It's not like Josh McDaniels just up and left and nobody saw it coming.
Yeah,
I mean, he left three or four years ago, took the Colts job, then just left them at the altar. Bless him for that, by the way. Not enough bad things can happen to that organization. But, you know, the idea that, you know, he interviewed last year and didn't get jobs. The thought that when he decided to go to Las Vegas, Belichick was running around the office doing jazz hands like, oh my God, what's going to happen? I didn't see this coming. Who's going to be the coach? There's always been a succession plan in place. It may change from year to year. And, yeah, a year ago, 2 years ago at this time, Judge was in New York and Patricia was in Detroit. And so nobody saw them coming back. But when they did, I think Belichick knew exactly who he has, you know, whom he can trust. And Don't be at all surprised, though, if he's the one calling the plays. You know, I refer back to when he was on the staff with the Jets in 1998, I want to say it was. Bill Parcells took over the play-calling duties. And all that team did was send three starters to the Pro Bowl, including Vinny Testaverde, who was like 37 or something at the time, and they went to the AFC title game. So I think, look, Belichick knows this offense forwards and backwards. He understands the changes that they've made, the adjustments that they've made from the McDaniels era. And, yeah, it's got, I don't know how it's going to play out, but I'm absolutely fascinated by the prospect that this is how it's going to go. And that here we are in mid-August, and we haven't the first clue whose voice is going to be in Mac Jones's helmet. Is just, I'm all in on the process to see how this plays out.
Well, it certainly won't be Adam Gase, that's for sure.
I thought for sure they'd bring Bill O'Brien back.
No.
But the most credible report I heard was that Belichick didn't want to do that to his pal Nick Saban. It's like, I don't know. It seems like it's a really nice boost for your pal Bill O'Brien. Nice, you know, promotion for him, and he's called it before. But, you know, maybe this was all just part of them saying, we need to change, we need to simplify. We've had too many receivers fall through the cracks because they couldn't grasp all the complexity. And maybe let's not make this be like a formula on the chalkboard that Will Hunting has to figure out. And why don't we just run a football offense for a change?
Just tired of seeing you screw this up because it's so easy for me. Sorry. Well, Jerry, we want to thank you so much for being here. Matt, you want to say something real quick before we wrap this up?
So we're going to circle back to the Tom Brady discussion.
You got 30 seconds.
You got 30 seconds. Football as a sport in the NFL is a mess right now. Yep. You've got the central office twiddling their thumbs as always. What do you make of the NFL in this day and age? The Brady thing, the Deshaun Watson thing. And ultimately, who's going to win the AFC East?
It all comes back to what I've been saying for years. Roger Goodell's birth was the punishment for the sins of mankind. And you know what? I'll give it to the Bills, but that's fine. I give it to the Bills until further notice. That team is a wagon, but I love the Pats as a wild card. You know, double-digit wins like last year. And it's all going to depend on whether they improved on the other side of the ball, because I just want to see the Bills punter this year. That's all. Just want to see
at least once.
Just once. It'd be nice to know that he doesn't get the day off. You know, that he doesn't, that he has to throw his uniform in the hamper just like every other punter at the end of the game, and not just hang it back up and call it a day.
Again, he is Jerry Thornton. Don't forget to check out some of the stuff he does on Barstool Sports, Twitter, and all the great social media platforms that he is a part of. Matt Mad Dog Nelson, want to thank you for joining us. And, folks, that is all the Monday Night Talk that we have in store for you. Until next week at 6:15 p.m., you have been tuned into Monday Night Talk.